Alright, so last time we were discussing the n-body problem and we had got a little past this transparency here. There are some minor differences between this and what you have because I improved them. So the data parallel algorithm uses the simple data parallel algorithm uses these three-dimensional arrays, which are transposes with respect to each other. One where things are replicated in this direction, and one when they're replicated in that direction. Let's see, I improved the font size. Alright, so this is some routine grav, which is the one that is given the positions and masses and returns the accelerations, and it defines the necessary arrays, which the largest arrays are 3 by n by n, and actually, as I mentioned, and we will discuss, summarize later on, the thing that's wrong with this algorithm is it uses a 3 by n by n array, whereas the best algorithm would use just actually 3 by n as the array dimensions. You do not. The only reason of using that last dimension of n is to have one dimension which corresponds to the iteration. And if you implemented it in a natural fashion, in a fashion we'll go on to later on, you will not need that. Alright, so so this algorithm uses the spread function, which is a Fortran 90 function, which has an argument called dim, which is essentially the dimension in which you want it to be replicated. So xi is replicated in the third dimension, and xj is replicated in the second dimension. So the rule is that when you remove that replicated dimension, you get back the original array. So xj, when you remove the second dimension, gets you back x, which says it's replicated in the second dimension. So that's why I said xi and xj are just transposed with respect to each other between dimensions 2 and 3, which is actually, the diagram in your foils is incorrect. The XIs are labeled incorrectly. They're correct. This web version is correct. I'll run you off a new paper version. So you can see the... So you can see, if you like, the good or the bad features, because we have a very simple formula, A equals G star D over R cubed, for the acceleration, but at the cost of making A, G, D, and R all three-dimensional arrays, whereas, and also M is a two-dimensional array. Whereas that's only an artifact of this particular algorithm. confused. Maybe somebody can explain to me where the mass, sorry, mass MS is also a three-dimensional array, and I think this formula's got to be incorrect. It's missing the product of the masses in that formula. That formula there is incorrect. I think there's a... what it should have done is set G to be a three-dimensional array which has got M and MS in it. I don't know what happened to that statement. I thought it was in there. But it should set G equal, which is a three-dimensional array, equals to the Newtonian constant times M times MS, where M and MS are just the masses transposed with respect to each other. That's just, it's just wrong. Because the formula for the gravitational force is the is G times MI times MJ times XJ minus XI all over the mod of XI minus XJ cubed. So it's R corrector. It doesn't alter the algorithm. It doesn't alter the logic. Alright, so this has got several problems. The first problem is, as I mentioned last time, Newton's law of action and reaction, that if you calculate the number of floating point operations, it's twice what you'd expect. So this is not using the fact that the force on force of I on J is equal and opposite to the force of J on I, which is called Newton's law of action and reaction, but is also transparently obvious from the numerical formula. And so there's some remarks which are about how hard it is to do triangular arrays, which just happens to be true, but sort of irrelevant because you shouldn't have used the arrays anyway. So I would claim the serious problem is that this is incredibly wasteful on space. That it uses it's using order n squared space, whereas the algorithm should be order n. And in fact, if you remember, we discussed this great machine called Grape. And if you look at logically why Grape, which is this special purpose machine to calculate this, to implement this algorithm, why it's so efficient, so cheap, it's because it uses no memory. It's because this is a problem which is order n in size and order n squared in computation, whereas most problems are some, if they have some measure of the size, then the computation is some constant times that size. It's not the square of the size. So a typical rule is you need a gigabyte of memory for a gigaflop of performance. And it's linear, roughly. The amount of memory needed is roughly linear in the computational power, whereas for this problem, the memory needed is the square root of the computational power. And if you look at any machine built today, the cost of the floating point unit is essentially a negligible cost of the machine. The cost is the memory itself and the cache and et cetera, which is all needed to access this huge amount of memory. So, there's also factors that it's off by, because it spreads everything to three-dimensional arrays, which obviously don't need to be spread to three-dimensional arrays like masses and stuff like that. So, well, it should say here that the obvious way of solving this problem, if I was writing in Fortran 77 or some standard language, is just to do a do loop over I and then do loop over j, which goes from 1 to I minus 1. So you just do the triangular sum. So that's if you were just sitting there programming it sequentially, that's how you would do it. However, if you look at that sequential algorithm, it's not easy to parallelize it. So the way we're going to do it is a way that makes it much clearer. It's a way that naturally implements parallelism. And if you think about the parallel algorithm, which we'll mention a little later on, we're going to have to use data parallelism. So that means we're going to put the particles we're going to take the particles and divide them up into groups and put with n proc processors, one over n proc of the processor of the particles on each processor. But now think about Newton's law, that I interacting with J is the same as J interacting with I, and we want to avoid calculating it. So that's sort of non-trivial, because the force of I on J is calculated on the processor which I lives in, and the force of J on the force of I on J is calculated on the processor which J lives in. That's the owner computes rule. The force of J on I is calculated on the processor which I lives in. Those are different processors. So it's not so trivial how to use Newton's law, because this anti-symmetry is on floating point computations which are in different processors. So the key idea is is in the communication. This is actually pretty difficult, I think, to build into, say, an HPF compiler to recognize this idea automatically. Because the key idea is that we're not going to just the trivial data parallel algorithm, which would actually not implement anti-symmetry, is to communicate, when I'm sitting in the processor which J lives in, I communicate the information that J needs to do this computation. So that would be the mass and position of particle I. But we do something slightly different. We communicate the mass and position of I and another variable where we're going to store this anti-symmetric force computation. So that we send back some information to the processor which I lives in, which is the force which I calculated in that sort of destination processor. So this, if you like, is a violation of the owner computes rule. Because to implement Fij equals minus Fji, I calculate it once and once only, and I only calculate it in the two processors I could have naturally calculated it in, I calculate in one and one only. So that's a violation of the owner computes rule, which is why it's almost impossible to automate this in HPF. So the way you implement it is the following. You take as a data, which is actually very elegant, you take as a data structure the position, the mass, and the acceleration of a particle, and you communicate that data structure, all three of them. So it actually says that, and to be efficient, we don't want to keep, we know we want to block everything together, so what we're actually going to do, we're going to send the acceleration, we're going to send the acceleration on a little trip through the processes. So the acceleration of I is going to have one component calculated from the processor which I lives, and another component that wanders around the machine gathering these anti-symmetric contributions and accumulating them in this circulating component, which then eventually ends back in the home processor. That's the sort of basic strategy. And it's implemented extremely easily because the topology of this is a very simple algorithm, a very simple structure, because it's essentially every particle interacts with every other particle. You can see that corresponds to essentially a one-dimensional type data structure. You do not have to worry about any three-dimensional structure for this problem, and we think about, as it shows here, two sort of two data structures which are 3 by n in, well, I guess, yeah, the 9 by n in size, if we replicate the mass, or actually 7 by n, because there are 3 x's, 3 a's, and 1 mass, and there are n of them. And we imagine one fixed and one just circulating around in a pipeline. And we just circulate this pipeline. If we circulated the pipe, and then the idea is you interact this thing with this thing, except you do not do it when the particles are equal, which is actually the case drawn here, and you only do it also for half the cases because you want to use the anti-symmetry. So what we do here is we've done one. So we've taken this bottom one. We left the top the same. And we're just on a circular shift of the particles by one unit. So now we can do something because x2 interacts with x1, x1 interacts with xn, xn interacts with xn minus 1. So if you think about it, if you just shift, if you do this shift, if you shift it n times, you'll just get back to the beginning and do these computations. Each time you shift, you'll get the ordinary algorithm which calculates everything twice as many times. If you do it half the shifts that you might have thought otherwise necessary, you'll automatically only calculate the unique forces. I forgot to mention, of course, that when you calculate you've initialized each of these accelerations to zero. This is the fixed acceleration, this is the moving acceleration. So this is a fixed acceleration for A1, and here's the moving acceleration for A1. So here, this calculates, adds into A2 the contribution to the acceleration of particle 2, which is 1 interacting with 2, and it adds with a minus sign into A1 the contribution of 2 on 1. So each stage you add once into here and once into a minus sign in that bottom row. So you do one computation but store it in two places, or accumulate it in two places, and then at the final result, when you shift it as many times as you want to, you just add the fixed and circulating objects, and that automatically gives you a computation which is respects the anti-symmetry. So this foil here, which is you do have, illustrates for two simple cases. So if we only have five particles, which is of course another very interesting example, you can see after two shifts we've actually calculated everything. So on in step one, we do P5 with P1, P1 with P2, on step two, we do P4 with P1, and P1 with P3. So there are, with five particles, there were four interactions we're meant to have done, and we've done them therefore in two steps. Half of them at the top, half of them here, and the other half are when P1s are at the, so that you think there are three with, sorry, there are two here with P1s at the bottom, and two here with P1 at the top. So this is the fixed case, and this is the moving case. In the case of six, you need three such shifts to calculate the five forces that are necessary for six particles. So you can easily, if you think carefully, you can convince yourself that this works. So here's this algorithm implemented this with a for all statement, which, so you can already see this has advantages. Namely, my arrays are now dimensioned 3 times n, not 3 times m by n. So basically it's the same. I have now a suffix c, which is the circulating versions of the variables. So it's extremely straightforward. And you can see here, so here I did get the mass right, and these masses have the gravitational constant pre-stored in them. So we first of all shift, and we're going to shift to begin with, because we don't want to do the first case where there's no shift, because that's xi interacting with xi, which doesn't exist. So it's essentially the same algorithm you had before, except that instead of these rather complex m by n arrays, we effectively have done it with these two copies of the position of the mass arrays, and we just keep shifting this second copy, so we access a different particle in the shifted copy, and you can see how we accumulate the fixed acceleration and the circulating acceleration. And well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do it. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm pretty certain there's a minus sign there. Because Newton's law is action and reaction is equal and opposite, not equal. So unless I'd missed something, there ought to be a minus sign. Unless there was a minus. So there's a boring last step, because if you notice the algorithm, there's a slight difference between the case when n is even and n is odd. Actually, the case of an n is odd is the easiest, because you have an odd number of particles. You remove one, that gives you an n-1 is even, and the number of interactions is n-1, because you don't interact with yourself. So n-1 over 2 is an exact number. So for an even, in the case of n is even, you have to do some cleanup at the end to get the last example, to get one final thing computed. If you look at the example of 6 particles on that earlier foil, you'll find on step 3 was special. Only one particle was computed in the fixed position. That's because that's it's just life. You just have to stare at it. And so finally, you have to do a shift to get everything back in the right position, because we've only shifted this pipeline halfway round. So we shift it all the way round, and then we add A to AC to get the total acceleration. So this algorithm is, as far as I know, clearly superior on all grounds from the previous algorithm. It's as efficient as you can make it, and uses order n space, etc. And also it illustrates, this is essentially the algorithm Grape would use, because this shows the pipeline the fundamental algorithm is implemented by just shifting data through a set of floating point units. So that says that if you want to do it in a parallel array, as everything is just shifting and we're just shifting through something labeled 1 to n. If we do my parallel implementation, I just need a one-dimensional, connectivity. So if you read my old book, Solving Problems on Concurrent Processes, or possibly also Chapter 3 of Parallel Computing Works, you will notice I wax eloquent on the fact that why this algorithm, which is the order, which is n-body algorithm, where the particles are in three dimensions, well, typically you would usually apply them in three dimensions, the decomposition you do is a one-dimensional decomposition, not a three-dimensional decomposition. The reason why that is there is there's nothing left of the geometrical structure. The reason you do in Jacobi's iteration we did a geometrical decomposition, we're chopping everything up in three dimensions, was that the force had something about three dimensions in it, because it was a local force. One particle interacted with the particles that were near it in three dimensions. And so the actual algorithm, if you like, the computer science data structures know about three-dimensional space. But the n-body problem, as everything interacts with everything else, it knows nothing about three-dimensional space. That's the mathematical structure of that algorithm has nothing about the only way a space enters in is the implicit summations over three dimensions and the calculating of the force, but it does not enter in the outer do loops, which are the things you're paralyzing over. So that says you do have to be a little careful in when you look at a problem and you try to look at the so-called geometrical structure, it is not always true that all algorithms for solving a three-dimensional scientific simulation have a three-dimensional structure. For instance, another obvious example is FFTs are a standard way of solving partial differential equations, these certain special types. FFTs do not have a particularly three-dimensional structure, because they're, again, a long-range type of interaction, because any one Fourier component involves all positions. So what counts in the decomposition is not always the physical structure of the underlying space. If you mathematically, it's a sort of structure of the algorithm space, and that's what really counts. But it happens to be true that in all problems where you have locality, the interaction of one object is nearby with respect to all other objects. In that case, there's an exact matching between the dimension of the algorithm space and the dimension of the physical space. So in these references, and I have foils on that, you will see I discuss the concept. I keep changing its name. I called it the system space or the information space, and introduced the dimension of that space, which you would say is one for this example. Alright. So, parallel implementation is trivial. You view it as this one-dimensional array labeled from 1 to n, and you just chop it up in this totally obvious domain decomposition. You can use any decomposition you like, because x1 is not particularly near x2 or x3, so you can use scattered decompositions or cyclic or what have you. Any decomposition that but an equal number of particles in each processor is satisfactory, because there's no locality. You do not need to respect locality at all. Alright, so this is a relatively tiresome calculation, which is calculating essentially the total communication and the total calculation time. Now, we essentially have done this already. If you remember what we did at the end of the discussion of the Laplace equation, I discussed the ratio of communication time to computation time and pointed out that but in the case of a three-dimensional problem, if you had a grain size of little m, which is here big N over m proc, for a three-dimensional problem, because it's edge over area, you get a communication time of a computation time that goes like grain size to the minus one-third in three dimensions, grain size to the minus one-half in two dimensions, and grain size to the minus one in one dimension. This problem here, it's very easy to see that the total compute time is, the total compute time, we have this pipeline with this, the fixed particles and the circulating particles. At any one step, circulate a group of particles. Let's assume I circulate one particle. That takes a time which is here, actually 9 or 7 times the total communication time. It depends whether it's 7 if you dimension the mass to 1 and 9 if you dimension the mass to 3. Then I've brought one particle, I've shifted over one particle. That one particle then interacts with all particles stored in that processor. So it does a total number of computation, which is just the total number of particles in the processor, which is big N over M proc, or essentially the grain size. So that says for every unit of communication, we do N over M proc units of computation. So that's why communication over compute time is 1 over the grain size, which, interestingly enough, is what you'd expect from a one-dimensional problem. So it has the classic formula for communication over computing, which is characteristic of a one-dimensional problem, which is good because one-dimensional problems are much better than three-dimensional problems because communication is edge over area, and for one dimension that's much better than three dimensions because three dimensions is the edge over area is the cube root of the size of the system. One dimension, it's the one-th root. It's the first power. So there's a consistency. We need the algorithm is one-dimensional because we just shift pipelines, and correspondingly, the performance model is one-dimensional. So this is another reason why he's saying, great, we can build special-purpose hardware. The communication needs are extremely modest. If you have a nifty piece of hardware and you want to prove it's great and you have somebody who's not very familiar, you do one of two algorithms, matrix modification or n-body problem. Those are the two which perform the best on all architectures because they have the best ratio of computing to communication. They make the best use of caches. They have the lowest overhead in any distributed memory application. If you want to look bad, you use FFTs or matrix inversions. Those have terrible performance. Actually, the worst, another very bad one is linear programming. That's awful, because that's a very sparse matrix, and it's very, very difficult to get good performance on that. So. I don't want to do this. Alright, so that's all I want to do on this ODEs. So what we're meant to have done from this module is we're meant to have introduced the ordinary discretization, discussed the various methods such as multi-step and Runge-Cutter for solving ODEs, and then illustrated for the n-body problem how you apply this method. As far as I know, I mean, the strategy for the n-body problem. Well, actually, no, I'm wrong. I was going to say it was sort of unique, but that's not true. There's some very... If you look at the... This idea of having moving accelerations, if you look at the very best nifty algorithms actually done by, I think people at Sandia did them, for some of the short range forces, they use the same idea of essentially violating the owner computes rule. So that is something to remember from this problem, that there are some very simple examples where the owner computes rule is clearly not the best implementation. And rather, it's best to, I think in all cases where it's not the best, you effectively take the computation, divide it up into parts, and then you distribute those parts in a way that basically means there's less data movement involved in calculating the parts. You do a bunch of computation on the parts in a way that doesn't involve much communication, and then you communicate the whole communicated object, which is then far more efficient because you do less communication. As far as I know, the only way of finding such algorithms is to have clever people who think them up. I don't know of any automatic ways of finding, of violating the owner's compute rule in any very deep fashion. You can do simple violations, but these are rather deep violations of the owner compute rule because they involve a rather non-trivial change. And the other point, of course, to make is this algorithm, although it's very simple, is still a very important algorithm, which underlies a lot of computations in chemistry and complex astrophysics. We may or may not have time to do it, or maybe we'll do it in some other class. There is this beautiful multipole algorithm which solves the same problem, which is order n log n, or order n, not order n squared, but it's not applicable for very irregular problems, because it's just the overhead of using it is too great, nor is it applicable for problems of size of about 10,000 particles, because you have an order n squared algorithm versus, say, an order n algorithm, but the order n algorithm has a coefficient in front of it, which means it only beats the order n squared at somewhere but a few thousand particles. And as chemistry problems with 10,000 particles are of great practical importance, this simple n-body algorithm probably uses a very... There's a lot of CPU time goes into it. So are there any questions on the n-body algorithm or differential equations? Can anybody read that? Probably not. So at this part of the course, we're just going through a bunch of different practical algorithms. And there is a large class of problems which effectively involve numerical integration. So we've currently studied, if you like, numerical differentiation. That's what solving ordinary differential equations is. if you, I mean, there is this field called applied mathematics, which I always like, I don't know whether I say I like to tease them, but it actually focuses it focuses on a set of very important numerical algorithms, but if for some reason that field has always done very little in the area of integration, even though if you actually look at supercomputer time, a large part of supercomputer resources are spent on Monte Carlo integration, which is an integration formula, not a differentiation formula. So it is not true that integration is unimportant. It's possibly of comparable importance, although there are huge classes of fields like computational fluid dynamics which would not use numerical integration typically. They would usually formulate the problem as a differential equation. Although I should say the classic probably most physics problems are done by Monte Carlo. So we're going to start off discussing some general remarks about numerical integration. We will then do some comments on parallel computing, and we'll also do Monte Carlo integration. There's another module we'll also do on random numbers, which is quite interesting general mathematics and parallel computing issues. So essentially, all formulae for numerical integration have the following general structure. So we'll write out these formulae initially in one dimension, although the most interesting examples are in a lot of dimensions, millions of dimensions. That's a classic physics problems correspond to integrating over all degrees of freedom of a problem, which is enormous. It's equal to effectively the number of grid points. You're integrating over all possibilities of a problem. Another area of interest, possibly to some of you, where of course Monte Carlo is very important, is financial modeling. Economic modeling is largely done through Monte Carlo methods because it involves integrating over all possible futures. You want to decide where to invest your large check you get every now and then that you have to do by summing over all possible futures and then deciding what the most likely winning strategy is. So most modern sophisticated financial modeling uses Monte Carlo. But anyway, all integration formulae have the simple form that they assume that the formula, which we will assume is of the form, we're doing an integral f of x of g of x. We can put g of x equals 1, but g of x is put there because it turns out that often you have a sort of an unknown function f or a complicated function f, and you have a g of x which might be x or 1 over the square root of 1 minus x squared or cos x or something simple which is some sort of natural weight function for the problem. Then you always write the integral I in the form of a sum over a number of weight functions w of r times the value of the function at positions x sub r. So the so-called Newton-Cotes formulae, which are actually the formulae, the simplest formulae, are gotten by, well, they take g of x equal to 1, but they choose the x sub r's to be just a equally spaced grid over the integration domain from a to b. So you just write the integral as some weight functions to be determined times the function at these grid points. So this is why it's going to end up very closely related to differentiation, because in differentiation, essentially, I take if I'm solving a differential equation between the points a and b, I take a little grid size h, and I define effectively a set of grid points between a and b with equal spacing. So these are the formulae, the integration formulae, which are the equivalent of the differentiation formulae we did. So Newton-Cotes formulae correspond to a very simple choice. So here we have a formula, integral from a to b of f of x dx is wi of f of x sub I. I've chosen m plus 1 grid points x sub I, so where x of naught is a and x of n is b. So I have m plus 1 weight functions w of I. You get a Newton-Cotes formulae of label n by choosing the m plus 1 w's such that this linear formula here is exact for all polynomials of degree less than or equal to n. So that's sort of a reasonable type of thing you're doing. Remember, when we differentiate, we're essentially saying there's only one thing in this class of formulae, you're just assuming f is smooth. So when I differentiate, effectively I assume that f is some I did Taylor expansions the whole time, assuming it was smooth. Here I'm, again, making a function assumption that f is smooth over this range a of b, and effectively approximatable by a polynomial. So if I make that assumption, I can take I of m as the integral from a to b of x to the m dx. Then if I want that equation to be exact for the polynomial x to the m, I must have this integral, which is a calculatable number, equal to these grid points x to r to the m times the unknown wave function w of r. And if you stare at this equation here, you will see this thing here defines a matrix of size m plus 1 by m plus 1. That's these x to the m sub r's. This is a vector of length m plus 1, and that is a vector of length m plus 1. So this condition becomes a simple m plus 1 by m plus 1 matrix equation that A times W equals B, where W is the vector of the unknown weight functions, and B is the column vector of the known integrals, and the matrix A has the form X of R to the M. Of course, I forgot to mention that if I make the integral exact for the polynomial 1, the polynomial x, and the polynomial x squared, and the polynomial x cubed, as an integral as a linear function, it's going to be exact for all linear combinations thereof. So to get it exact for all polynomials, I only have to get it exact for these monomials, x to the 0 through x to the n. So finding Newton-Cotes formulae is entirely equivalent to inverting matrices. which you just do. And you notice the matrix is essentially, well, for given A and B, which when you take, or you always transform variables, so that A equals 0 and B equals 1, so that means for given N, there's essentially only one matrix equation to be solved, which, you know, Coates was a typical English clergyman of the 19th century, which is, you know, in the good old days, they didn't have graduate school or anything like that. You enrolled in the church, and then in your spare time, after you've given your sermon, you studied mathematics. So if you look at some mathematics books of the 19th century, you will find that a lot of them have the Reverend XYZ as the author, because that was the day of pure study, you know, none of this, well, this stuff wasn't useful, this was pure intellectual study, and there were a few brilliant people in the universities, but otherwise it was done by the clergy as the people who had the time and possibly the education to tackle such issues. Those were the good old days. Anyway, so obviously even clergymen were quite capable of inverting these matrices, and so this is not terribly. These aren't very good pictures, actually. So this should really look like this. Alright, so the simplest Newton-Cotes formula is two points, which if you solve the matrix equation, you will find that W of 0 equals a half, or I should say, probably a half into B minus A, and W of 1 is a half into B minus A, and so the Newton-Cotes formula for N equals 1 is that the integral from A to B of f of x dx is a half B minus A into f of A plus f of B. And that's entirely equivalent to drawing a straight line between f of A and f of B and doing the integral underneath them. The next case is N equals 2 in this unfortunate picture, which has actually a straight line rather foolishly for the function. It should be like that. It's it effectively is it's entirely equivalent to drawing a quadratic function between f of a plus b over 2, and f of b, and then you'll find if you solve those matrix equations that w of 1 is b minus a over 6, w of 0 is 4b minus a over 6, and W of 2 is B minus A over 6. So the weight functions have this magic ratio 1, 4, 1. Now this is going a little... So this illustrates... Actually, these pictures here show quite a lot of, actually several possible scenarios, which we'll explore in a tiny bit more detail in the following foils. So if you were really, you know, if you really were a good mathematician and you didn't do too much work in your sermons, you could have probably also done this case, which is the higher order Newton-Cotes, where here you've drawn we have 5 points, and we put a quartic through the general quartic through those 5 points. So, however, it turns out in practice you essentially never do that. Rather, what you do almost always is this if you're lazy, or that if you're not so lazy. And what this points out is if I go from A to B with equal space, I actually can make several different assumptions. The simplest assumption is here. I just assume that the function's a set of straight lines. from A to this point, this point to this point, this point. So it's just straight lines. In the limit in which the grid size goes to zero, that's totally accurate because this is an this is a perfectly reasonable formula which gives the right answer in the limit of the zero step size. So this and this effectively correspond to the discussion we had about the difference between simple integration formula like the modified Euler's and the multi-step formula. Remember in the multi-step formula we had errors that went to zero much faster because we were fitting polynomials effectively to several points. We had differentiation formulae which would involve predictor, in general with predictor-corrector technology which might involve effectively a given point in the last three or four points or something like that. I had these Adams-Bashforth type formulae. So that's equivalent to this. And this, the error here is formally smaller than the error here. It goes to much zero much faster than this one. But there's also another possibility, which is to actually take this and draw a quadratic through it, and take this and draw a quadratic through it. Notice these are different assumptions because here I have a totally smooth function. Here I have a discontinuity in derivative, and here I would have a discontinuity in derivative as well. So effectively I'm making a different assumption about the function. Here I'm assuming the function's a polynomial over a to b. Here I'm assuming it's linear, piecewise linear. Here I'm assuming it's piecewise quadratic. And I'll come back to the last diagram later on. All right, so these are these, so that's trapezoidal rule, that's that straight line formula. And here's Simpson rule with these magic coefficients which you should remember. And I happen to have got a 2 here in the middle. So this is what I said, b minus a over 6, 4 b minus a over 6, b minus a over 6. And if you look up in standard textbooks, you will find these formula for third order, fourth order, fifth order, sixth order, seventh order, etc., depending on how diligent they were. You will find them all listed. And I'll come back to discuss why you never use them. Essentially never use the high order formula for a couple of reasons which we'll discuss later on. And this foil, I've only had one. Well, what this foil points out is that you too can invent your own formulae, because I assume the xi's were equidistant, I assume g of x was 1, and I assume the first point was a and the last point was b. You are allowed to write a formula, integral of I of f of x from a to b equals times f of x of g of x from a to b equals a sum of a grid points of WR of f of x sub r. Now that's a nice formula because it's linear, but you're allowed to choose any choice of the x sub r's and effectively any choice of g. And all of them end up by just inverting different matrices. anything is. You can do it. And at least in practice, I must admit, many, many years ago, I had a numerical problem where I needed to solve a huge number of integrals which had a relatively smooth function multiplied by a particular form for g of x, which was given to me by, I was solving some inverse transforms which had a particular g of x. And so what I did was I just re-derived the Newton-Cotes formulae for that g of x by just inverting the matrices by numerical inversion. I didn't calculate them exactly. I just, at the beginning of the program, I formed the matrix, inverted it, and then used it thereafter. And I'm sure that what I did was far more accurate than directly using Newton-Cotes, because, as I think we'll mention later on, the essence, you know, of all practical computing is sort of common sense. So all these choices, like those pictures on the previous page of the different ways of doing a five-point integral, they're all mathematically correct, and you have to use common sense to decide which one is best. So you can use, you can write, if you have the integral of some function f of x times the square root of 1 minus x squared, you can let f prime of x equal f of x times the square root of 1 minus x squared and use Newton-Cotes on f prime. Alternatively, you can diligently solve the matrix equations for g of x equals the square root of 1 minus x squared. You would solve the matrix equations for g of x equals the square root of 1 minus x squared if you wish to get them, you know, you wish to do the best job, in the case where f of x, where f of x is the coefficient of the square root of 1 minus x squared, is a very smooth function, and smoother than f of x times the square root of 1 minus x squared. So you sort of have to be sensible. If ever you've got this thing suggests a certain function is smooth, then you should expand that function, and not another function, which obviously, if you like, has some unsmooth thing in it. So that's sort of the law of common sense which governs differentiation, because you can often differentiate either one function or a function multiplied by a weight function. It governs interpolation and it governs integration. You can always make choices. The choice is always, you have to think what your assumption is, because when you write down numerical equations, you're making assumptions, which you have to. And you've got to use your understanding of the problem to decide what the right assumption is. The mathematics tends not to tell you that, it just says these are the possibilities. You have to know enough about your problem to know what's likely to be a polynomial, or what's likely to be a sensible choice of x's. All right. So this analysis, so this is a summary of the error, and this tells you why you use Simpson's rule, at least why you use it to compare the trapezoidal. Now, the error in the trapezoidal rule is some coefficient which you have to diligently calculate times the second derivative of the function f in the region a to b. You get that by using the same, what's it called, the mean value theorem, or several times you'll find that you can show that. And it's easy to see that the coefficient is going to be h cubed, where h is the grid size, or proportional to the grid size. The trapezoidal error goes to zero like the grid size cubed. Now, you would have expected Simpson, because it has one higher order, it's exact for a quadratic, that the error would be the third derivative of f times h to the fourth. However, that is not true. It's the fifth power of h times the fourth derivative of f. And the reason for that is if you like, extremely simple. It's because the integral of x cubed from minus 1 to 1 is 0. So it cancels due to symmetry. So you'll find that the Newton-Cotes formulae with g of x equal to 1 always have this peculiar feature that the formulae with 3 points, 5 points, 7 points are all one accurate to one higher level than you would have expected, and they all correspond to the fact that you see they have this equal, they have this symmetry in the coefficients, which you can easily see has to be true, and that symmetry implies that any the odd part of the polynomials must vanish identically. So we use Simpson for the following sort of trivial reason. It's unexpectedly accurate, and there's two powers of h better than trapezoidal, and people can remember 141, you know. I mean, you know, you can remember seven numbers at a time or something, that's your short-term memory. So 141 is something that anybody can remember. So it has a nice simple formula for the coefficients. So it's not much harder than trapezoidal, and you gain a lot in error. Much better, much more accurate than trapezoidal. Now, you do have to remember a little more than 141. You have to remember 1, 4, 2, 4, 2, 4, 2, 4, 1. Because what you really apply in any real problem is 3 points or whatever the normal Simpson's rule has 3 points. So very few cases when you're calculating something of importance is a 3-point integral enough. We want maybe a 21-point integral. And we do not use Newton-Cotes with polynomials of degree 20. We typically use an iterated Simpson's rule, which I illustrated on the previous transparency. So the iterated Simpson rule then is if we go back to that if we go back here, the iterated Simpson's rule, we have Simpson from here to here, Simpson from here to here, Simpson if we continue from here to here, and so you have 1, 4, 1, 1, 4, 1. And so the 1's add up in the middle to get a 2. So when you apply Simpson's rule into just contiguous regions, all that you get the 4's, and then you get 2's in between the 4's. So the pattern is 1, 4, 2, 4, 2, 4, 1. That's what you have to remember. So I just alright, so this is why, unfortunately, all this work by clergymen 100 years ago wasn't terribly valuable. Because you can, instead of 1, 4, 2, 4, 2, we can do this wonderful Newton-Cotes of by applying polynomials to however many points we have. And then we get seemingly a wonderful formula with some huge power of the grid size. In the error, so that looks good, except if you like, you have this coefficient which is a huge derivative, and if you have a function which has got any pathology whatsoever, if you differentiate it too many times, that differential is going to get very bad. Another way of saying it, which is more intuitive, which I mentioned to you before, is if you take a high order polynomial, high-order polynomials have lots of wiggles in them. So the quadratic has one wiggle, cubic has two wiggles. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, a minimum and a maximum. So a higher order polynomial, you fit it to a point, it's going to have a lot of wiggles. And so what happens if you actually do this, and your function isn't a polynomial, you will find this miserable interpolating high order polynomial you put in, you've used, has these huge unnecessary wiggles, because it's got to try to fit this polynomial. It wasn't a polynomial anyway, and it does it by wiggling a lot. And so which is mathematically saying that if the function ain't a polynomial, it has very high order differentials. So this is a whole field of statistics called robustness or something. There's always a trade-off between accuracy and robustness. So a high-order Newton-Cotes formula is very accurate because it has a very high coefficient of the error. But it's very non-robust because to get that high high power of the step size, we had to do something dramatic. We had to assume that it was a polynomial over the entire region A to B. Well, that's not a very robust assumption, because it's much safer to assume it's a polynomial over this region, and there's a different polynomial here, and a different polynomial here. That's a much safer assumption than there's a polynomial over this huge region. I mean, if you believe in, well, it's not if you believe, if you know about complex planes and singularities, to make it a polynomial over this region, it says there aren't any singularities in that circle, which includes that, in the complex plane, which includes that part of the real axis, whereas if it's, for me to get it polynomial in a small region, I just have to draw a lot of small circles, a small radius. So I'm making a much stronger assumption. So that sort of illustrates again how computation requires understanding of the functions. If you know your function's analytic over the entire complex plane, you should use a high order Newton-Cotes, because that's good. But if you're not certain, and you think that it might not be a polynomial, then when you make an assumption that it is, you're putting information in, and if that information is wrong, your numerical solution method will just give the wrong answer, because you've made an incorrect assumption. So, you know, the high order error corresponds to you putting into the problem an assumption, and you need to examine such assumptions. That's why I say computation is some large fraction of common sense. You've got to use a numerical method that fits the problem. You use the wrong numerical method, it gets the wrong answer. The mathematics, once you've made the assumption, the mathematics will tell you the properties of your assumption. But if you've asserted something about the problem which is just false, the mathematics will not correct that. It can't. All right, so we'll set the problem set on Thursday. I've been out the last 2 days, so. And then we'll proceed with this study of integration. Thank you.